If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there, and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Later this week, on the 29th of January, Netflix's new film The Dig is released. It tells the story of the famous 1939 excavation of the early medieval ship burial at Sutton Hoo in Suffolk, England. Our content director, David Musgrove, recently put in a call to the Sutton Hoo expert, Martin Carver, who's led excavations at the site from 1983 to 1993. He wanted to get the full story of the extraordinary archaeological site and the real dig that inspired the film. You can listen to an extended version of this interview, including Professor Carver's memories of digging at Sutton Hoo himself and his unorthodox golf ball geophysical prospecting technique at historyextra.com/Sutton-Hoo-extra.
So the first thing that I think would be good to talk about is basically to get a bit of an introduction. So we're talking about Sutton Hoo. Could you, in the best way you can possibly do, attempt to introduce Sutton Hoo to us? What's the story of the place, and how should we understand it?
Well, the place itself is enchanting. It's a piece of rural Suffolk. A stretch of grassy terrace, and it looks over the River Deben, which leads out to the North Sea. So in some ways, the River Deben acted in the old days like a kind of front door to Suffolk. And so you could come up the River Deben, and from there you can then disperse into the eastern part of Suffolk. It's got a few spinneys, sort of small woods, down by the river. And it's the river, of course, has changed a lot because it was once much wider than this and much more tidal. And now it's been embanked and so on. So it's different to what it would have been in the 7th century. It's become famous because of the discovery of the great ship burial in 1939. That wasn't the first excavation to happen there, but that's the one that's made the place a household name. So It's really popular. It's insanely popular as an archaeological site, but it also has this sort of other aspect. It appeals to the sort of Gothic in people as well. So it makes guest appearances in all sorts of romantic literature. But on the whole, the following is very enthusiastic, and people are bowled over by how rich and how interesting, and in some ways how intelligent people were in the 7th century and the kind of governance that they had and their anxieties about which religion to align with and which part of their, and who in their neighbours, whether Christian France or pagan Scandinavia, basically. These were the big... I should emphasise that we're in the 7th century with Sutton Hoo. We're not in the Viking period, which starts 200 years later. But it's easy to confuse the two, because in many ways the Anglo-Saxons and the Scandinavian Vikings had similar ideas and similar practices.
So let's just wind it back a second here, just to, for our listeners to be super clear on what it is. So Sutton Hoo is a cemetery. It's a series of graves of different forms and different sorts, which were established, as you said, in the 7th century. But you describe it as a story of three acts. So do you want to just sort of go over that? How is Sutton Hoo a three act story?
Well, it starts with a prelude, because it was occupied from the Neolithic times, Bronze Age, Iron Age, Roman, sparsely. And when the Anglo-Saxons came, they came up the River Deben and would have seen some earthworks which belonged to prehistoric fields. But that wasn't the first. That wasn't their first impact on the landscape. Their first impact, really, was a family cemetery, high status, but a family cemetery, which was placed more or less where the visitor center is now. In fact, it was excavated in advance of the visitor center. It was 6th century, and it had warrior graves and rich female graves as well. And that family then became the predecessors of the royal line, which was buried in Act Two in the great mounds that were constructed about 300 metres to the east. And those mounds, 18 of them that have been recognised, these mounds contained cremation burials, and that's to say where the cremations were placed in bronze bowls, something they'd already started to do that in Act One in the family cemetery. So that's the sort of connections we can make between the two. It only lasted about 50 years. It's sort of 690 to 740. 50 glorious years in which the descendant family, if I can call them that, almost certainly the Wuffings, tried to construct a pagan kingdom in imitation of Christian kingdoms, but very much keeping their own relationship with Scandinavia, which of course was still pagan then. So the mounds you see today are all quite small because they've been ploughed out, but there's one big one, which is the one we reconstructed. That's mound two. So it looks like a kind of slightly lonely place. It's just grass, occasional bit of gorse growing, and looking down to the River Deben. And in a course of time, after the royal episode, if I can call it, after the royal burial ground was abandoned, which would be roughly around the end of the 7th century, and this is the time in which Christianity reached East Anglia and was fully embraced, some 70 years after Augustine arrived. And at this time, this burial ground, the royal burial ground of the pagan dynasties, became something to be avoided. And what we found in our Act 3 was it was used as a place of execution. And so people were hanged and buried rather roughly around Mound 5 within the Royal Cemetery and on its edge as well. We found traces of the gallows. The people were buried in all sorts of strange positions after they'd clearly after they'd been cut down from the gibbet or the gallows. And then they had no grave goods or anything like that. So these were people who'd survived only as sort of sandy brown forms in the ground. So it was a very poignant discovery and such a change from the great royal cemetery with its gold and silver and so on. This has now become a place to park, let's say, dissidents. That's how I think of them anyway, people who didn't want to go along with the new Christian regime. And they transferred their allegiance elsewhere, churches, graveyards, and so forth, Bury St. Edmunds. These are the places where were the new focal points for the new Christian regime.
So what's the period, when's the Act 3 period? What's the start and end point of that, these deviant burials?
8th to 10th century is the period of the executions that we found. And they were dated by radiocarbon dating, so that's how we could put them into the sequence.
Okay, but the big sort of glory period and the period from when the main boat burials come from is the 7th and 8th centuries. That's kind of the big high point.
Just the 7th. Just 50 years at the beginning of the 7th century. It's not very long at all. So it's like one of these great bursts of activity. One imagines that these mounds are very demonstrative. The burials are very extravagant. Horse burial, ship burial, very richly furnished. They are strong statements about the wish to continue this particular regime, this dynasty. And in some ways, they're a sign of anxiety of what's coming at them from over the channel. In other words, a more obvious Christian Union as a kind of reenactment of the Roman Empire, which they really don't want to be part of. So I think that's why the investment is so big. People are calling to their gods, if you like, for protection by making these investments.
So, but there are some hints of some sense of Christianity percolating into these graves, aren't there? There's a bit of intersection.
Oh, yes. I think it's pretty controversial, or has been more controversial in the past. I don't know whether you've read Angus Wilson's book on Anglo-Saxon attitudes. That's a really nice portrait of the Sutton Hoo dig, where he contrasts those who wish it were Christian with those who feel it's pagan. In other words, people take sides about this. But just to give my own view so it can be judged, I would say that in Mound 1, we do have objects which have Christian symbols, like the silver bowls, like the Great Anastasius dish. They have Cairo, they have crosses. However, these are imported from the Eastern Mediterranean. They're imported from Byzantium, which is the old name for Istanbul. That's where they came from. So everything there has got crosses on it because that's the hub of a Christian empire. So if you want a silver bowl, especially a finger bowl, special high-status feasting bowl, then it's not unlikely it's going to have crosses on it. So I don't think that's a definitive statement. I think the definitive statement is the huge investment of digging a giant trench, putting a 27-metre-long ship in it, a sacrifice, and then in the boat, in the chamber, putting a huge number of grave goods of different kinds. They excavated, they found 263 objects, of which, you know, came coming from 62 artifacts, which the British Museum carefully put together after the dig. And these represent an extraordinary range of objects.
It's always a good time to talk about Sutton Hoo, but there's a particularly good time now because there's this book and film, The Dig, all about this first major excavation of the site in 1938-1939. Now, so it'd be good to just sort of drill into that story and understand what's happening, because it's a really interesting story. It wasn't the first, that excavation, before we go into that, that wasn't the first time that people had taken interest in digging into these, into the barrows there, though, was it? People had been messing around in advance of that.
Yeah, there's two main digs that happened beforehand. One is in the 16th century, which is really like a looting operation. And the technique there was to drill down a big shaft into the centre of the mound and then help yourself to what was ever in them. A lot of the mounds had been treated in this way. And then in the 19th century, a slightly more antiquarian approach. The mounds became the subject of more curiosity, and they were trenched. And the way they were trenched is that you, if you have the mound in front of you, you dig a small pit to see where the top of the subsoil is. It shows yellow as sand. And then you drive the trench straight through the mound until you hit the side of the burial chamber, which should show up as a sort of black area. So that was the 19th century dig. So nearly all of them had a trench like that through them as well. So in 1938, when Mrs. Pretty came along and to live in Sutton Hoo House, she was a person who had a great interest in archaeology. She'd visited Egypt. She'd been involved in the family dig, if you like, in Vale Royal Abbey, where they used to live, with her father and so on. So she knew a bit about how archaeology worked. And when she bought the estate, she and Frank Pretty had bought the estate, they realised they'd got a monument there and decided they could, or she decided to excavate after he died. She decided to excavate probably because she was intellectually curious, although there was this element of a lonely widow hoping to make some sort of contact with the other world that her husband had just gone to. She did have a medium in London. She did have a liking, you know, for this kind of, for consulting a medium about getting in touch with the other world. I think that's the best way of putting it. And so she got this dig going in 1938. She got a digger from the Ipswich Museum, so its director, Guy Maynard, suggested Basil Brown, a local character, very self-taught, ingenious, but not fantastical, a good brain he had. And even though he hadn't got the advantages of being educated this way and the other, he had a tremendous flair, a great intuition for understanding how archaeological sites are formed. He studied them by looking at sites that were open. Sometimes he couldn't get in because they were private property, so he used to bicycle to the edge and then look at the section through his binoculars to see how the layers were forming. So he was a clever digger, also kind of a wild one, according to his contemporaries, described him like a terrier after a rat. But I think his genius was to recognise what he'd got, and he seemed to be better than that, almost than anyone else in that team. So he started in 38, dug three mounds. Mrs. Pretty chose them. He found that each one had been dug already, had a hole through it. And he also found that the objects that survived were Anglo-Saxon. So he was expecting Bronze Age, because that's what most of the mounds are around there. But he found bits of glass and so on. He thought, this is Anglo-Saxon. He didn't necessarily think they were Viking, but he knew that the Viking burials were related. So he got himself books, he looked at them, learned more about it. And then in 39, Mrs. Pretty said, okay, I think that was a success. So let's go and look at the biggest mound. And he said, that'll be all right for me. That's what he's put in his diary. I said, that'll be all right for me. So he did. She'd put a long iron probe into the top of Mound One and hit a stone, not that surprisingly. That's how it started. And then he used his normal method of digging. Now, his method of digging was really the same as the 19th century. So he would start at the edge, dig a little test pit, see where the subsoil was, and then cut down the sides of a trench. And as he got nearer and nearer the middle of the mound, so the trench got deeper and deeper and deeper. And that is what caused the collapse. He had three collapses in 38 and a big one in 39, quite dangerous. But the reason that people perhaps didn't use shoring and that kind of thing as much as they should was that they wanted to see the section clearly. So if you could imagine this mound like a sort of cake, and you cut through it, you can see all the section, you can see all the layers in section, and that gives you the story of how the mound was built. Quite important. It's not how we do it now, but that, and it wasn't really how they always did it then, but, you know, he was using techniques that had been used before in Suffolk, and he expanded them to a certain extent. So when it came to the middle of the mountain, it had collapsed, he then started cutting it back. So he cut it back in a stepped form so that it didn't fall in on him. And he kept going, he kept digging. But the point about this method was that after about 2 or 3 days, he realised in the case of 1939, Mound 1 burial, that it was wrong. And that was because he met an iron rivet. And he'd met one before. In 1938, he'd found an iron rivet and discovered that these were used to hold ships' planks together. So he knew that. And so when he discovered this rivet, he said, stop. He was digging then with his Mrs. Pretty's gardener and gamekeeper. John Jacobs was the gardener, and William Spooner was the gamekeeper. So those were his assistants. And one of them found this piece of iron, said, I found a piece of iron, and held it up. And he said, okay, let's have a look. So he looked at it and he thought, this is a ship. This is a ship. So now we're going to do it differently. So we don't need to go straight on now, because this ship is already below the level of the natural sand, the top of the natural sand. So he got his pastry brush, which he got from Mrs. Pretty, and just dusted down the top of each rivet. So it made a little red stain where the iron had rusted, and gradually worked his way down inside the ship. So there wasn't any wood there, just a little black here and there, but mostly it's the pattern of the rivets guided him down and down and down until he got to the chamber. And then he recognised that he'd got to the chamber, and so he stopped digging, and he went straight across the top of it like a big black rectangle, a few little bits of metal sticking out. But he poked it with his finger a bit, but he didn't disturb it. He just went straight through to the other side. Now, at this stage, Charles Phillips arrives. So Charles Phillips was a fellow Selwyn College in Cambridge, and he had heard in the centre of all archaeological gossip, which is the coffee room of the Department of Archaeology at Cambridge, he heard about this boat being, there's a Viking ship, wasn't, but they said, it's a Viking ship being found in Suffolk. They're digging it. So he went down on prehistoric society business to Sutton Hoo. He met Mrs. Pretty, and he was taken to see the dig, and he describes his amazement, even horror, when he saw this fantastically huge heap of earth, and then the giant trench beside it, and then the rows and rows of rivets. And he said, oh, no. I think my godfathers was the expression he used. So you can see he thought, my. Anyway, he then called the British Museum, and there was various sort of discussions about who should come and so on. But the British Museum and the Ministry of Public and Building and Works, these are the authorities of archaeology of the day. They had problems. Their problem was the imminent arrival of World War II. So the Ministry of Public Buildings and Works is in charge of a lot of other things besides archaeology. And so it was busy reinforcing the dockyards. And the British Museum was busy moving its collections into the London Underground, where they were going to spend the war. It wasn't the ideal moment to start a big dig. On the other hand, how could they not finish it? If they'd put the earth in, by the end of the war, there wouldn't have been anything left in there because everybody would have had a good old dibble. So they had to go on with it. They gathered a team, as Charles Phillips says, he doubts whether we could have had a better team than the one we were able to gather. These were mainly people who had other jobs, but they were waiting call-up. So they were kind of available during that hot summer of 1939. Stuart Piggott was the best digger and probably the best archaeological brain among them. W.F. Grimes became a professor later. Peggy Guido married Stuart Piggott. O.G.S. Crawford came along. Graham Clark was there for important days. So it's like a boatload of professors to be. They weren't professors then, but they're all going to be professors. And they had lots of brains, but I think when it came to excavating and recording, Stuart Piggott is the standout star. He was not only a very good archaeological recorder, but he's also an artist and a poet. He was an extraordinary person, I think. And he had a very good way of recording in drawings and photographs and written drawings. I doubt whether anybody could have done as good a job as him now if faced with those circumstances. They had no money. They had some scaffold poles provided by the MPBW, which Phillips said very little use could be found for these. So really, they had... Well, everyone smoked a pipe, so they had the ubiquitous container of the pipe smoking era is the tobacco tin. So they had loads of those. And to pack fines, they packed them in moss. So they were pretty resourceful, They had a shepherd's hut on wheels. Extraordinary, really. Very talented people with an impossible job and the war coming.
The picture you've painted there is very interesting. It's because you've kind of moved from, it seems like you've kind of jumped straight from the antiquarian era where you've got a landowner paying somebody to investigate their sites, in the form of Basil Brown, straight through to kind of the start of professional scientific archaeology and this team of really, well-educated people. Something did the methodology change sort of immediately that Charles Phillips turns up? And did Basil Basil Brown do a good job with his early work?
Well, unquestionably, he did a good job. He is the one who's given us the shape of the Mound One ship. I don't think it was immediately recognised that he did a good job. Between the layer of Basil Brown, who you might call an archaeologist of genius powered by native wit, and the establishment figures from the university, there's another layer, and that's the sort of museum curators in Ipswich and so on. And these people were more officious, I think. They criticised Basil Brown. Guy Maynard did, Reid Moy did, They criticise Basil. He records what he put in his diary, and he's extraordinarily stoical about this criticism, more or less saying, they'll say that, but I'm right. that's what he's... And he was, too, absolutely. So he wasn't immediately recognised. And Phillips was given the job by the British Museum and the MPBWs, so sort of officially, if you like, given the job of finishing this excavation. And like everybody who's given a job, he might have abrogated to himself a certain amount of power. I am in charge. I'm in charge, but I've got my own peers working with me. What do I do with Basil? And in a way, I used the phrase Basil was relegated to steerage class by the new team, but I think that's a little bit unkind. I think they understood him and what he'd done very well, but they wanted to impose a new kind of more precise recording on the burial chamber. This is perfectly understandable. And I'm sure that conversations took place which are not recorded along the lines of, have you dug a burial chamber before to Basil? And he probably said, well, I've done one or two smaller ones, but this is bigger than anything I've attempted. And if they were honest, they would have said, well, you know, me too. This is much bigger than anything any of us have undertaken. And he remained on the excavation. He remained on the excavation. So history and photography doesn't really show what he did. But the chances are that he was putting the finishing touches to the 27-metre-long ship, which is, after all, the main area that was open. And he took a lot of care of that site. You know, he was also its caretaker. So I don't know. I would have liked to have been a fly on the wall, you know, to hear what the conversations were, because if you step back from this whole event, what you're looking at the beginning of the Second World War is the beginning of the losing of the power of the upper class. And so there was some kind of class, I don't say antagonism, I think there was some, it was a class event. And I think that on the whole, people were very well mannered and were very courteous to each other. We don't have any evidence that they weren't, including the gardener and the gamekeeper, and all these people, of course, were employed at the big house. So they didn't have any interest in making trouble. But you can bet your boots that they listened very carefully to Basil, particularly Stuart, is my guess, because he was the man who knew the soil, soil. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. So that theme of sort of a class conflict is quite does come through in the book and the film of the dig. It seems like quite a big theme that the author and filmmakers have chosen to bring out. And you think that's a fair reflection?
I think conflict is too harsh. I think there were disadvantages in being Basil Brown, in that he lacked the education he deserved and the experience he deserved and the income he deserved for what he was doing. And there were disadvantages in the professorial class. They weren't professors yet, but you know what I mean, too, because I don't think they had the understanding of how the different layers of soil form in a large burial or in any archaeological sites. I mean, they only know about the ones that they were digging. And when they dug them, they'd have used the same old intuition. There's no real textbook which tells you everything you could possibly encounter under the ground. And so my guess is that, you know, in my mind, Stuart Piggott was the most sort of earthbound of all the of the Dons, and recognised not only Basil Brown's native wit, so to speak, but also his intelligence. I'm convinced of that. I've met Stuart, but I never got a chance to have a chat with him about Basil Brown. It was at a much later conference, and I was much younger. He was much older, so I didn't get that. But people who are alive now who knew him very well, you know, and admired him, definitely. So I think that relationship, that relationship for me is special. It was almost like people meeting outside the class system.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
This is a warrior grave. It's got swords, spears, angons, shield, so on. So it's likely to have been the memorial of a man, even though we don't have anything left of the man. There are other indications which are slightly worrying in a way, that the shoes were size 7. That's quite small for a man, but who knows? He might have been short and stocky.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
That's a nice phrase, earthbound. That's a nice one. I'm wondering, you mentioned that the excavation happens just in the dawn of the Second World War,
yeah.
With all this trouble looming. How, obviously nobody knew when exactly anything was going to happen, but there was a sense that that trouble was brewing and brewing, yeah, very quickly.
Yeah.
So I guess they knew there was an urgency. How did that urgency impact on the way they dug the site? Would they have done it a lot differently had conditions and circumstances been different?
I don't know if they would. I think that's too difficult to say. I expect they would, yes, but I mean, I think they would have taken a very long time over it, and so would we now. You know, we would erect a shelter now over the, you know, because the weather is what they were worrying about more than the war. I mean, if the war's going to come, it's going to come, but the weather can damage the site while you're digging it, and so I think they were more worried about that, and that meant hurrying. They did hurry. They did dig it very quickly. They dug it in 17 days. I suspect they were worried about being called up because then you'd have to go. So they wanted to get it done, you know, while they were there. So that's what I'm expecting they were worrying about. I think it's easy to worry. I think easy to see now we know that the war did come. I think what they thought was that the war could come, and that's different. You know, it could be another year. It's all been brewing, after all, you know, since middle of the 1930s. So it isn't as though it was there was a fixed day for it. When war was declared in September, the dig had finished, but the boat hadn't been recorded. So they went on recording the boat while they could. And Commander Hutchinson was able to do that from the Greenwich Museum, from the National Maritime Museum. So he was able to continue with that work. Other things spoke of normality. They held an inquest. who owns this £1 million grave? And they held it in the village hall in Sutton, and the magistrate found that the owner was Mrs. Pretty. The law that the magistrate was working on was quite medieval, treasure trove law, which is basically if somebody's buried something with the intention of going back and recovering it, then it is government property because they were trying to evade tax. That's the thinking. A layman's version of the thinking. But if, on the other hand, it's buried with no intention of retrieving it, then it belongs to the landowner. So I'm not in a position to comment on the rationality of this law, but because it was, they could demonstrate, or they gave evidence, they gave converging evidence that this was a burial, even though they didn't have a body. They gave the converging evidence that it was a body, that it was a burial. Therefore, it was the property of Mrs. Pretty. And Mrs. Pretty is thought to have consulted her medium, according to Charles Phillips. And then the next day she said, I give this to the nation. And they said, well, the nation makes you a dame of the British Empire. And she said, no, thank you. I don't need that. This is no achievement of mine. So that was quite interesting. And anyway, then because it was given to the nation, it all ended up in the British Museum, spent the war there, spent the war in the London Underground, and then came back after the war, and a long program of research took place under Rupert Bruce Mitford, brilliantly restoring objects from very many fragments to the objects we see on display today.
So tell us about the objects and the finds there.
Well, if you were there at the day of burial, you would be looking over from the side of a trench onto this long clinker-built ship, and in the middle would be a cabin. It's like a kind of a very strongly built small shed with heavy planking. And inside the shed, you would be able to see a large tree trunk coffin. The evidence for this only came up really in the last 10 years or so, but I think it's pretty good. And so take the lid off that. What you'd see actually is a person lying in the coffin. No trace of that person remained, but there was a person in there. And then at his feet, there were heaps of clothes. That included such things as two pairs of shoes, size 7, an otter fur cap, a really interesting set of leather garments which had buckles. Not quite sure what they were like. I don't think there was enough left of them to see what they were like, but the leather garments were there. And in this coffin, there were also what you might call sort of toilet sets, the silver bowl, ladle, cup, little burwood bottles, 4 knives, and 3 combs. So those things seem to belong to a person. They're personal things. And then you imagine that lid being closed, and then on the lid were the more public accoutrements, public things that people wore in public, helmet, a kind of the baldric, a kind of sort of Sam Brown connected with gold connectors, a gold buckle, huge solid gold buckle, and the gold buckle could open like that. And in the gold buckle there was obviously some kind of lucky charm or a relic of some sort. You just slide 2 little things at the back of it. When I was first started, I went to the British Museum to see this stuff and was shown it by Leslie Webster, the keeper. And she handed me this buckle, and almost as soon as it hit my hands, it sprung open like that. I thought, oh, no, I've trashed the gold buckle, finally. But actually, no, it all fits back nicely together again. So a beautiful military uniform, if you like, with gold parts to it. And then there's a little gaming set of gaming pieces as well. There's a little bell, probably comes off a hawk. And then feasting. So maplewood bottles, drinking horns, giant drinking horns made of aurochs horn. And then a big silver dish from Byzantium. So this coffin lid bit is like status uniform plus feasting. Warrior king plus giver of feasts, giver of gifts, giver of feasts. And then at the west end, there was the regalia. There's an iron standard leaning against the wall of the chamber. There's a scepter. There's a shield. There's a hanging bowl, which in it, well, in the hanging bowl was a lyre, a sort of four-string musical instrument, in a beaver skin bag to protect it. And so here is the master of the rebels and also the leader of the armies. And at the other end, the east end, is a sort of cooking end, three big cauldrons with chains. So this is like a furnished mini hall. The man lies in state. He has his personal things with him. On the lid are his uniform and his invitations to the feast. One end there's cooking, the other end there is parade gear, regalia. Absolutely, you know, a tremendous sight. And this was all put together, of course, after the dig of 1939. They came up with 263 pieces, and the British Museum found them to be 62 separate items. Amazing.
And sorry if I missed this. The helmet
was on the lid. So the helmet was on the lid of the coffin. So the lid, if you can think of the lid of the coffin as a sort of quite a big, like a table almost. At one end, it's got the silver dish and then the drinking horns. And then in the middle, it's got the baldric with the gold buckle. There's also a sword with a gold pommel. And then beyond that, the playing pieces. And then right at the end, where the head of the person probably was, but above it, was the helmet. And so you would be able to look at this. In my imagination, it's not so easy to prove. I think this spectacle would have been available for several days, perhaps longer, for people to walk around the edge and look in. And they would be people who obviously knew the dead man. One imagines that this whole funeral was created by his wife, his unnamed wife, who seems to be quite a character. And the people who were looking on would know something about each of these objects. Ah, that's the sword witch. And that's the helmet that he first wore when, you know. So each of those objects is like, has its own biography. It's making its own kind of news report, if you like, to the people who are looking on. And they're telling their children what's there. So we're not dealing with a literate society. We're dealing with one which tells each other things and then the next generation remembers what the previous generation said and so on, so it's handed down. And, of course, Christianity was a big threshold over which some of this, a lot of this, never crossed, which is why archaeologists love to dig it up.
So that's a fascinating picture, isn't it, of people sort of processing round and looking down and seeing all these goods. A couple of things I just wanted to pick
up. Sure.
So the body's never been found there. Is that's because it didn't survive because of the soil conditions? Is that right?
Yes. Sutton Hoo's the natural soil at Sutton Hoo is an acid, or the subsoil is an acid sand. It's really acidic. We tested it out by burying some pork chops and bread in it. And by the time we dug those things up 2 years later, they were black. They could still be distinguished from the sand. And in fact, even in the dig, even in the big 39 dig, they could tell where wood had been because it left a little sort of straight edge in the yellow sand. But that is very acidic. And as far as the body is concerned, if it's acidic as that. It attacks the bones. It attacks the bones. It takes the evidence for the bones away. So the body would have become like the ones we found in our Act Three, where there were victims of the gallows. And those bodies had turned into a kind of brown, body-shaped brown sand. So imagine that was what happened to the king in Mound 1. His body would turn into brown sand. He may have had some clothing on, but that would have gone as well. But then he's lying on a wooden floor, and then he's surrounded by this shed, and the shed has got a roof. And above the roof of the shed is many thousand tons of earth, which was placed in the ship, followed by the mound. So it would rot and then compress. So I think the chances of finding a silhouette, for example, of a body in that circumstance would be very, very, very difficult. Stuart Piggott, who's in some ways the hero of this excavation, very experienced excavator, excavated lots of Neolithic sites. He said it is exactly what you would expect. It does not mean there was no body there. He said this at the inquest, and it was quite an influential point, I think.
And just in terms of the person buried here, you've said you've called him a man a couple of times. Is there absolutely no doubt that it is a man? Is there any scintilla of a doubt about that?
Well, there's virtually nothing in archaeology that can't be doubted by someone. that's how it works. But in this case, the evidence is quite convergent. It's quite good. It converges. That's what I always think is the best thing, is if it's looking in the same direction. That's a pretty good indication. In most of the warrior graves in Anglo-Saxon England, we have skeletons. And in general, like 99%, they're all male. This is a warrior grave. It's got swords, spears, angons, shield, so on. So it's likely to have been the memorial of a man, even though we don't have anything left of the man. There are other indications which are slightly worrying in a way, that the shoes were size 7. That's quite small for a man, but who knows? He might have been short and stocky. So I think it's a man. And on the whole, what we do have from that period is some intimation of the people who ruled the coming kingdom of East Anglia. So we have certain names. We have the Wuffinger group with Wuffinger as its founder, as the family founder, Wuffa. And then there is a descent from that. There is a family tree in which it's possible to infer dates. They all belong to the late 6th into the 7th century. Redwald is thought to be thought to have died around about 620, something like that. And so even though the dates may not be super precise, even though they're precisely given, you know, 624, for example, in the case of Redwald, it's all convergent. It's pointing in the same direction. It's pointing in the direction that by the end of the 6th century, beginning of the 7th, a family existed which claimed themselves as the leaders of an incipient kingdom of East Anglia. And so there isn't much evidence to contradict that, even though people have speculated a lot about who might have been in the mounds and so on. So they're not labelled, there's no written evidence, so it is hard to be 100% sure. But that's the convergent evidence, which I personally think is pretty good at the moment.
So you would go for King Redwald as being the figure most likely to have been.
I would. I think since the a great and wonderful H.M. Chadwick chugged over from Wales to Sutton Hoo in 1939 and saw the burial and said, "It's Redwald, I've no doubt about it." I mean, he wasn't speaking from a study of the finds. He just is somebody who'd studied the period for 40 years in Cambridge, and there wasn't anyone cleverer around. So I suspect he probably was speaking from some intuition, but also from all the convergent evidence that he carried in his head. Yes, so I do believe pretty strongly that that's what happened. This is a kingdom in formation from the late 6th century through to about the middle of the 7th century. It may not all be the same family. They may not all be super close, but they are probably well known to each other. One is succeeding the other. We are told in the documents who was king after whom. And it ends with the conversion to Christianity of the East Anglian kings. We wouldn't expect them to be buried after that at Sutton Hoo, if this is the royal burial ground, and we can't find anybody there either. So the last person there is a woman, and she's buried about 650. And she's buried on a couch and has silver accoutrements, the only woman that we found. She seems to me to be a very good candidate for the unnamed wife of Redwald, who Bede didn't like very much. Bede thought Redwald was being misled by his wife. But actually, his wife was more politically astute, I think, than Redwald was. She was a really interesting person. And for my money, she was the designer of this burial, with all its references to France, to Rome, to the Middle East even, to Scandinavia, to the northwest of England. It was a real statement, real poetic statement, I think.
Okay, so we need to look to the Venerable Bede to find out about this unnamed woman, and she's talked about there.
Yes, she's talked about there. I mean, basically what happens is that she knows that the people of Kent have gone across to Christianity, and that has in some ways put them in the power of the French. Stop me if any of this seems familiar, but the king married had a French princess, and then they were beginning to create a Christian kingdom down there. So Redwald went down to see what was going on, and came back to East Anglia and said, "Well, I think it's great, this Christianity. It's going to make us rich." And I don't know what she said, like saying, "Well, we are rich already," probably, because they were very rich. But they could see that trade would be opening up in the main continent, main part of the continent, if it wasn't already. She advised him to go steady, you know, not to actually sign up. And so he compromised by putting... he had a temple at Rendlesham, just upstream from Sutton Hoo, and he put it had some idols of various gods of the Anglo-Saxons there, and he added one for Christ, and said, "Oh, well, there you go then, so we're now covered." And this, some people would say, good, real politique, that's what we like to see. Others would say, well, all you've done is upset two lots of people instead of just one. But she was also very crafty. When Edwin was on the run, he took shelter with Redwald, and Redwald was paid by his pursuer, Ethelfrith, a large amount of money to kill him. And Redwald couldn't resist apparently saying anything. The first thing that came into his head, told his wife that, "Look, this is pretty good, isn't it?" And she said, "It's a terrible, terrible thing to do. Once you start betraying your own people, then you have no future." So I think she was pretty astute, and she was level-headed as well. I mean, I don't think she was against Christianity. I think she was a bit more wait and see. Let's see what they do. Let's see whether they bring oppression or whether they bring opportunity. It's all you can do. And I think that makes her a pretty sharp person, right?
Can you give us a sense about where we are now with Sutton Hoo? How do we understand it, and what's the interesting research and approaches that are going on?
Yeah, certainly. Well, we've written some books, of course, and we've tried to work out tried to meet the task we were given, basically, which is to find out what the Mound One ship was doing there. And it seems now that we've got these three cemeteries, one after the other, the first one being a 6th century family cemetery, then the Royal Burial Ground, and finally the Execution Ground, that this was a story of the early days of the Kingdom of East Anglia, members of the upper class becoming kings, and then especially related to the pagan world, Scandinavian world, and of course the Franks had been pagans in the early days. North Europe had plenty of pagans left in it. There was a strong feeling that this was a kind of independence that they wanted to keep. And in many cases, you know, their ancestors had been enemies of the Roman Empire, so they weren't keen to get Rome back again. But the Christianity of the time was very Rome-based and was not unlike, its ambitions were not unlike the imperial ambitions of the Roman Empire. So you can see there would be a political building during this time. I think the study of the burials and how they were done, the kind of ritual aspects of the day of burial, the extraordinary range of objects, what they meant, why they were in the tomb. Clearly, it's not everything that was in the tomb. They were carefully chosen. The influence of Redwell's queen. All these things, for me, they converged into quite a good bit of history, which made us see what the early days of England were like, at least from the point of view of the elite, or those who confronted the elite or challenged the elite. There's lots more to find out. I mean, the broader scale now is being explored in Suffolk. Probably the most notable of the new work is that at Rendlesham, where Chris Scull has been opening up an extraordinary site, very wealthy, active over a long time. Probably had a pagan cemetery, certainly had a church in the latter stages. The whole of Suffolk is a place of enormous interest in that period, right and up until, let's say, late 7th, early 8th century. Then things did change quite radically as the kingdom became much more resolutely and permanently Christian. And as far as Sutton Hoo research is concerned, we have a wonderful visitor centre. There's a museum in it. We invite people to lend us objects and to make an exhibition around them so that we're always learning about the mound period of Europe, all over the north and the west of Europe. You find these mounds. The circumstances are slightly different, just like they are with churches. But the meaning is that they are, I won't say religious, but they are sentimental centres which give a strong feeling of belonging to the people who live around them while they still know what's in them. And, of course, that's something we now know again. We haven't... It was lost for many years when... in the medieval period, for example, the mounds were made into rabbit warrens. They were farmed as rabbit warrens. But now people know again what these mounds are, and I think therefore see them as more precious and maybe see them as part of the identity of the land again. I hope so, because I think that's really what they are saying.
So one more thing. If our listeners are going to Sutton Hoo, and they're going for, and you know, lockdown notwithstanding, and when people are allowed yes. to go out again, what would you do? How would you best experience the site? You know, you're an expert, you've worked there.
Yeah.
Give us some advice for a casual visitor.
I think it's beautifully organised now by the National Trust. So you start the day by parking in the car park, and then you can go to the exhibition hall, and that gives you a film about what happened on the dig and what people have discovered since. The exhibition shows a replication of the chamber, which changes from time to time. I think the latest one is a little bit more ethereal than the one before. And then it gives little biographies of the main players, Radwald and his queen and so on. So it's a nice exhibition. And then there's a tea room, as there is in every National Trust site. Then you can go on a guided tour of the... They've just opened a new part of it, actually. I must mention that. In Mrs. Tranmere's old house, there's now an exhibition of the period of the dig, that is to say 1939, with the tools that were used and all those sort of things. So if you're a fan of the book, The Dig, I think you'd be... you'll really enjoy a visit to Sutton Hoo and to see the way that they've made Mrs. Tranmere's house into a part of the visitor experience. Then you go out onto the site and you'll see a lot of grassy mounds and one big one. And the big one is the one we've reconstructed. That's mound two. Hopefully by that time you'll have a sort of working knowledge of which mound is which. I think they could go further and put a label on and even hazard a guess about who was buried in which, but that's considered a step too far, I think, by the present National Trust managers. And then when you've done all that, you'll notice that next to the tea room, there is a big open space. Now, that space was the space that we designed in the original design to hold the Mound One ship reconstruction. And that Mound Run reconstruction is now coming into a possibility. It started in 1984, I think I first started to try and make it happen. But it's now been made happen by a group of sea lovers from Woodbridge, just across the river. These are people who love sailing and yachting, know a lot about the sea and the river. And they are building the Mound One ship, all 27 metres of it, in a hangar on the quayside at Woodbridge. So the keel is laid. They are using volunteers. They are open to the public. They have closed circuit television where you can watch what's happening. You can watch the planks being cloven, and you can watch the rivets being made and so on. So it's hugely exciting. And I think if we're spared from more epidemic, we may be able to get that ship built in next year or two. And then it'll go on trials. And hopefully it'll have its own TV personality and sail the North Sea and the Irish Sea, the Baltic Sea, and go into ports and introduce the Anglo-Saxons to people who never met them before.
That was Martin Carver, who's Professor Emeritus at the University of York and an expert on Sutton Hoo, leading excavations there from 1983 to 1993. His books on the topic include The Sutton Hoo Story, Encounters with Early England. The film The Dig is being released on Netflix on the 29th of January, and it's based on a fictional account of the excavation and a book also called The Dig, written by John Preston. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back tomorrow when Ian Mortimer will be speaking about inequality in the Regency era.